This is Matt Wells at UN News. Well, it's a little known fact that soldiers from every African country took part in the First World War, which ended exactly 100 years ago last month. To remember them and those from even further afield who also made a major contribution, an exhibition at the UN in Geneva, hosted by the Mission of Belgium, has provided a fascinating insight into their experiences on the front line in Northern Europe from 1914 to 18. Dr. Dominique Den Hooven from the In Flanders Fields Museum in Belgium sat down with UN News' Daniel Johnson.
It came as a surprise to us to realise that actually more than 60 contemporary states were involved in the First World War in Europe. And that basically, of course, had to do with the fact that we're talking about world empires in the beginning of the 20th century, well before the end of colonialism. And both the British and the French brought people over from almost all of their colonies or dominions. And that explains the extremely wide range of peoples on the Western Front in the First World War.
So just give me an idea of some of those cultures and some of those nationalities that were involved in the war.
For instance, in the New Zealand Army, you would also find Maori, but not only Maori, but also people from further afield, the Cook Islands, Tonga, and Fiji Islanders. The Fiji Islanders even had a unit of their own, the Fijian Labour Corps, which was actually quite small, but they were here. There were people from New Caledonia fighting in the French, or working actually in the French army. Nearly every African country was represented on the Western Front, and so was every Caribbean island.
You also make an important point in the exhibition that, in fact, many of even the French troops and the German troops didn't speak the national language. They spoke their own dialect, so communication must have been a huge issue, and I guess that is one of the interesting facets of your research.
Interpreters and the lower-graded officers were extremely important because they were the middlemen between the rank and file and the officer class. And it was one of the basic problems that both the French and the British armies faced is when a large number of, for instance, junior officers were killed, sometimes units were left with no ways to communicate. There is even one very remarkable instance where a group of Pathans in the Indian Army started communicating French because they had been, by the moment I'm talking about, they had been in France for a while, and they were more fluent in French than by staying in France than in English. So it was one of the basic problems was communication. The sense of alienation must have been horrendous.
Yes, and I was going to ask you about how the 60 nationalities felt about the people they were fighting for and working for, whether they were Chinese labourers, whether they were from Senegal, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast, and you say everywhere on the African continent, in addition to Vietnam, Madagascar. What do these people think about their superior officers and their comrades in arms?
Well, actually, what you see is the development of a kind of what I would say proto-nationalism. The Indians at home, there was a certain sense of India, but people did not meet across castes or religions. Yet, by being in Europe, they were actually forced to stick together more, and they found what bound them together. And so you see the development of a national sense among most of these groups. At the same time, it's the first time that large groups from all over the world were brought to Europe. So it's the first time they will see European civilization for real, apart from the colonial figureheads they would have met at home. And so what they realize is, on the one hand, the advances that Europe has, like on the field of technology and education, you see that there is a clear will to emulate that at home, to found schools, etc., when they return home. On the other hand, they say, okay, well, these are the people who tell us that they will bring us civilization. We have witnessed in person what European civilization, what the result of that. And actually, these people are killing each other with the technology they have developed.
Do you see that in some of the letters they wrote home?
Yeah. For instance, in letters the Indians wrote home or in memoirs Chinese laborers wrote after the war, they say, well, okay, European civilization does a lot of good things, but regarding spirituality, I am very sorry.
Let's maybe move on to the legacy of the First World War then. It obviously led to the birth of the League of Nations and multilateralism, a sort of desire to talk about some of the world's problems rather than fight. It had a democratic legacy, arguably, in Germany and elsewhere. What can we say about where we are today with multilateralism? Because the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres of the United Nations, has been commenting on the fact that it is 100 years since the First World War, and multilateralism is under threat in many senses.
Yes. Well, definitely in 1919, even if the League of Nations ultimately failed, we see in 1919 as the realization that if we want to prevent a war on such scale, multilateralism is an absolute must. At the same time, you see the start of a development towards a larger inclusion in the international stage. Even countries who were not yet independent were presented in their own rights at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 and later in the League of Nations. Again, the example of India is telling. India only became independent in 1947, but was one of the signatories of the League of Nations Charter.
And just talking about the Paris Peace Conference you mentioned in 1919, what were the concrete objectives that it wanted to achieve, and what can we actually take from that peace conference that we might apply today that might better help the cause of multilateralism?
Well, I think the lessons of the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 are largely negative. I mean, it failed to a large extent. It obviously wanted to establish a multilateral system, which then became the League of Nations. But also, it did a lot of things wrong. I mean, the high ideals of Woodrow Wilson, for instance, self-determination of the peoples, was implied only to a certain degree, and only in the case of European groups, but then European groups from those who lost the war. So you see that they left out a large part of the world, that's to say the whole colonial world. And that is very important to learn from the mistakes made at the Paris Peace Conference. For instance, that you can't just draw a line on a map to create new borders and to create new nations. And there's a lot of other things. What you actually see in 1919, that one of the results of the Paris Peace Conference was a lot of more regional conflicts who were often as bloody as the Great War itself.
And finally, where do you think we are today with multilateralism? Do you think that we are seeing more partners getting involved in taking part in the global discussion between the international community? I'm thinking not just countries, I'm thinking civil society and the business community.
Actually, the commemoration of the war has enhanced to quite a degree the inclusion of groups formerly not included, realizing that we were also in it to a large degree. So the answer is a bit double. The fact, at the same time, we see a growth of multilateralism, including many other groups. At the same time, you see that nationalism is also growing stronger. So the First World War was very interesting because you could see on a local, regional, and let's say an NGO level, civil society level, that the sense was towards a very inclusive commemoration. But on the other hand, what you saw is that quite a number of the countries involved on the official governmental level only focused on the role their own country had played in the war.